Los Angeles is shut down. It, unfortunately, is being turned into what seems to be a permanent beachfront nuclear waste dump. It's right on the edge of the ocean, in an earthquake and tsunami zone. And all the regulatory bodies involved with it seem to be in lockstep compliance with owner Southern California Edison's wishes. You may think this is just some local nuclear issue that California is dealing with, but then you learn...
What we're talking about at San Onofre isn't a little local regional issue. This is something, we've got 104 of these nuclear sites. There's no place to take this waste because we don't have a national repository for it. And so just about every state in the nation is going to be dealing with it in their backyard.
Well, when you understand that the nuclear industry manipulations of San Onofre and at San Onofre are a test run for a template for dangerous decisions that will be made in your own backyard, you begin to see how close each one of us is to that terrible nuclear seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. An update on Southern California Edison's latest manipulations around the shuttered San Onofre nuclear facility, now a de facto radioactive waste dump on the Pacific coast. We'll talk with Charles Langley and Nina Babiars of Public Watchdogs about 5 separate lawsuits filed by their organization, and how Edison and the California Coastal Commission manipulated information to hide a crucial permit to demolish the spent fuel pools, something akin to not only painting ourselves into a radioactive waste corner, but tearing out the floorboards and demolishing the house in the middle of a wildfire. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than we will be getting from the Democratic National Convention this week. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, August 18, 2020, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. In Illinois, Exelon CEO Chris Crane acknowledged that Exelon's standing in Springfield, the state capital, is at an all-time low because of revelations of corruption at its Commonwealth Edison unit, and at the same time said that ratepayer help for financially ailing nuclear plants cannot wait. Decisions on whether those plants will close or not are looming and will undoubtedly be made based on how much money, taxpayer dollars, Exelon can blackmail out of the government and whether they consider it worth it or they'll make more money with Holtec off the decommissioning. Crane said, "We will not run plants and lose free cash flow or earnings on assets that are not supporting themselves." Isn't that the essence of capitalism? If your business can't cut the mustard, you put the lid on the jar and you throw it away? Nuclear, the endless money pit. Listen to the interview with environmental trial attorney Terry Lodge on Nuclear Hot Seat number 473 from July 28, 2020, to learn more on the background. In Iowa, the hurricane-force winds of the derecho storm caused the Duane Arnold nuclear facility, 11 miles northwest of Cedar Rapids, to lose its connection with the electricity grid and cause a scram, which is an unusual event, according to the NRC. An unusual event being step one on a 4-step scale to kiss your posterior goodbye. Loss of external power. They don't generate their own electricity. Strange but true. That loss interferes with the ability to cool the plant, and that is what led to the Fukushima accident. By the way, Iowa also lost 43% of its planted crops. So if you're planning on eating sometime in the next 10 months, buy your staples now. In Southern California on August 6th, Southern California Edison maintained its more than 50-year record of discharging radioactively tainted waste from the San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station into the Pacific Ocean. This latest release was nearly 19,000 gallons, enough to fill a 16 by 32 foot swimming pool, and brings radwater discharges from San Onofre up to just under 100,000 gallons since the beginning of July. Over to Japan, where Fukushima's radioactively contaminated wastewater is still being considered too risky to dump into the ocean, no matter what the politicians say. According to a new study of TEPCO data done by Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute researcher Ken Buesler, found that it's not just tritium in the wastewater, but carbon-14, cobalt-60, and strontium-90, which all take longer to decay than tritium, and fish and marine organisms absorb them comparatively easily. So as for Japan dumping its radioactive water from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean, as they said at the end of the movie Time Bandits, don't touch it. It's evil. Last Friday, August 14, a Kyoto News survey showed that nearly half of Japan's 47 prefectures said they are opposed to or held negative views about hosting a deep underground disposal site for high-level radioactive nuclear waste. Yeah, join the rest of the world. This is due mainly to opposition from local residents. Go local residents. Meanwhile, the mayor of Sutsu in western Hokkaido, one of the prefectures that did not want the nuclear waste, is bracing for a backlash after stating that he wants his small town to be considered as a final destination for nuclear waste by the central government. Why? One suspects that in the three-stage process that can take up to 20 years to choose this storage site, the central government provides any municipality that has applied with annual grants, totaling up to 1 billion yen, 9.3 million U.S. dollars, per year, just for being considered. When it comes to nukes, follow the money. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
Ah, the political recycling of the nuclear cheat sheet. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe gave two commemorative speeches at the anniversaries of the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Except he didn't give two speeches. He gave the same speech twice. And that has got the Hibakusha, the survivors of those two atomic bomb blasts, really upset. A plagiarism detection app found that Abe's speech in Nagasaki on Sunday, August 9, duplicated 93% of the speech he had given in Hiroshima just 3 days earlier. And yeah, the boilerplate of, "I reverently express my sincere condolences to the souls of the great number of atomic bomb victims. I also extend my heartfelt sympathy to those still suffering even now the after effects of the atomic bomb." That works for both of them. But couldn't you just change the languaging a little bit, frame it a little bit better, show some interest and some effort on be part of these people who lived through hell? The Hibakusha deserve better. Specifically, they deserve to have Japan sign on to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons put forth by the United Nations and currently only 6 ratifications short of being international law. That's what they deserve, even if you can't get around to changing your speeches. So what? What was your thinking? Hey, it was both the atom bomb. A lot of people died. It happened a long time ago. What's the big deal? Well, it is a big deal. Because people need to remember, and they need to take steps so it never happens again. And just because you're a toady to the United States and our nuclear obsessions does not mean that you have done the right thing for the people of Japan, let alone those who survived the nuclear bomb blast. And because of all that, Shinzo Abe baby, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, I get it. There are so many issues begging for our attention and involvement these days. From COVID-19 and its economic impact, its health challenges to you and your loved ones, the U.S. presidential election, the Postal Service, global warming-influenced wildfires, ice melt in the Arctic, and extreme weather events, international warmongering, and I'm sure you've got your own personal list of issues that are making demands for your attention, pulling at your heart and your soul. And now that the Hiroshima-Nagasaki anniversaries have passed, mainstream media has clearly maxed out on nuclear stories and has gone back to publishing nuke industry talking points instead of investigating what they need to investigate. So it's easy for all of us to lose track. Yet, even if this planet and the people on it defeat COVID, improve the financial well-being and health of the populace, even turn around global warming, the problems of the nuclear fuel cycle and the radioactivity it releases will remain. And that is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We don't get distracted around here. We look at the nuclear aspect of our world every week in depth. Nuclear Hot Seat is the only program you can count on to report the ongoing, evolving nuclear truth that the industry would rather we not hear about, let alone understand. But financially, COVID has hit us really hard, which makes your help to keep the show going more important than ever. We rely solely on your donations. And that's why the time would be right now for you to help support us. To give a donation, just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the big red donate button. That's where you can make a donation of any size. And that same red button is where you can now set up a monthly $5, the same as a cup of coffee and a nice tip here in the U.S. Please, do what you can now, and know that however much you can help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here is this week's featured interview. Shutting down a nuclear reactor does not take away its dangers. It just shifts them into a different conversation, to a different set of problems, and a different set of manipulations by nuclear industry interests. San Onofre is a case in point. Permanently shut down in 2013, the past 7 years have revealed a history of negligence, lies, and dangerous decisions by owner-operator Southern California Edison regarding decommissioning and what to do about the spent waste. Their focus is on doing the necessary work on the cheap. And if they're allowed to get away with it, this region, and really by extension the whole country, will be at risk of a dangerous Chernobyl-level radiation accident, and the impact will extend virtually forever. That's why it is good that there are groups working to turn these bad decisions around before it's too late. To that end, we talked with two leaders of the nonprofit safety group, Public Watchdogs, Charles Langley, who's the executive director, and Nina Babiars, a board member. Now, they may call themselves watchdogs, but I consider them bulldogs when it comes to protecting the public and forcing the feet of the nuclear power players into the fire. We talked about the latest San Onofre issues, as well as a really sneaky trick they played on all of us to get a permit that they should not have been able to get that easily and that invisibly. And our conversation took place on Friday, August 14, 2020. Charles Langley, Nina Babiars, thank you so much for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby.
Glad to be here.
Right now, Public Watchdogs has five separate legal actions that you are taking part in as regards San Onofre. What are they? Bring us up to date on them.
I just want to say, Libby, we value social activism around nuclear energy immensely. We think it's terribly important. But about 3.5 years ago, we made a really strong commitment toward legal advocacy because we realized that if anything was going to be done in this specific situation at San Onofre, it would have to be done at legal gunpoint. So we've initiated five, actually going on six, legal actions to halt the activity at San Onofre.
And we would like to give just a brief summary of where we are on each of those. Public Watchdog's current update is that last year we filed two lawsuits in federal court. One specifically, Public Watchdogs versus the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC. That particular lawsuit in federal court was granted an appeal, at which this past June 3rd, we had the opportunity to make our argument in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal in Pasadena. Of course, it was done Zoom. But the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal is about the highest you can get on the West Coast. And so we are awaiting a decision from that particular argument of June 3rd.
And what was that argument regarding?
Well, it's about the nuclear waste canisters at San Onofre being approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that are insufficient for the scenario of being buried 108 feet from the Pacific Ocean on an earthquake fault in a tsunami inundation zone in the middle of millions of people. And so, you know, the key focus of Public Watchdogs versus the NRC is the jurisdiction that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has on anything radioactive, and how they either failed to regulate or that they used their regulatory authority to amend Edison's design failures and to make them okay.
Libby, let me paint you a picture of what's going on there, just so your listeners really understand. What we've got are 3.6 million pounds of nuclear waste, and it's solid waste in the form of spent nuclear fuel assemblies. Now, nuclear fuel, when it goes into a nuclear reactor, is perfectly harmless. It's in a 17-foot long, basically nuclear log composed of fuel pellets. They put it inside the reactor, they bombard it with neutrons, and when it comes out of there, it's deadly radioactive. The plutonium that is created as a man-made metal in this process of this reaction is deadly for 250,000 years. It's so radioactive, if you get anywhere near one of these spent fuel assemblies, you'll die within a matter of hours, if not minutes. So it's incredibly deadly stuff. At San Onofre, they take these things and fit 37 of them. They're 17 feet long, into a canister that's 6 feet wide and 17 feet high. And they fit into an egg crate type structure. By the time they're done, the whole thing weighs 100,000 pounds. It's got 50,000 pounds of nuclear waste inside it, and the canister itself weighs about 50,000 pounds. They then take it on this pulley type structure, and they inter it in the beach in these deep concrete silos that are about 20 feet deep. And this is in a terrible location, as Nina said, 108 feet from the beach, and it's in a tsunami inundation zone.
And we actually have some great video on our website that Charles is describing. It's a great opportunity for your listeners to go to publicwatchdogs.org and to take a look at some of the work that we've done to show this procedure that Charles is describing in a way that anybody can watch.
What got us involved is we found out these canisters, which are only 5/8 of an inch thick stainless steel, they're only guaranteed to last 25 years. So you've got nuclear waste that's deadly for 250,000 years and canisters that are only guaranteed to last 25 years. So we've got some serious problems there.
And the legal action of Public Watchdogs lawsuit against the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is specific to their failure to regulate on behalf of the public safety. That's the bottom line. I'd like to repeat that, you know, they have failed to regulate according to the NRC's mission, which is to regulate on behalf of the public safety. And that particular lack of regulation by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is why that particular lawsuit is entitled a negligence lawsuit against the NRC. So we are awaiting the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal decision that was argued on June 3rd in Pasadena. And our attorneys have advised us that if we are not successful in winning that argument, then our only recourse would be to go to the Supreme Court on that particular lawsuit. However, we feel that no matter what the outcome is, we're going to win, because if we have to go to the Supreme Court, and of course we never know if they're going to actually accept the case, they're pretty picky about that, but it is something of national consequence. You know, what we're talking about at San Onofre isn't a little local regional issue. This is something, we've got 104 of these nuclear sites. There's no place to take this waste because we don't have a national repository for it. And so just about every state in the nation is going to be dealing with it in their backyard. So I'd just like to reiterate, we're still awaiting a decision, but if we do have an opportunity to take it to the Supreme Court, of course it would elevate this to what it really should be, and that's something of national consequence. The second lawsuit that we have was filed, Public Watchdogs versus Southern California Edison, San Diego Gas and Electric, again, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and Holtec, the manufacturer of the cans that Charles just described. And that was also in federal court, and we also were granted an appeal in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal, and the date has been set for September the 1st for those arguments to proceed. Last year, in a third legal option or activity, we filed suit in April of 2019 against the California State Lands Commission. And the reason that we did that is the California State Lands Commission had the authority, had the jurisdiction to approve Edison's final environmental impact report. And you can take a look at the detailed reasons why Public Watchdogs filed notification prior to that State Lands Commission vote to approve the environmental impact report. Because, number one, they were voting on something with just four more days of the final report of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to come forward to be released on the accident of a near-miss drop in August of 2018. So we were asking them simply wait 4 days, but they didn't do that. Why? Because it was a prerequisite. Edison needed the State Lands Commission to approve that final impact, environmental impact report, in order for Edison to go the next step forward to the Coastal Commission, California Coastal Commission, and get their permit to demolish the rest of the buildings. The other issue that our case was based on was that because of that accident in August of 2018, which is greatly detailed on our website, Edison had about two-thirds of that radioactive nuclear waste still in some of the buildings because the burial had been suspended for 11 months. So how can you possibly give a permit to take down buildings at that point in March of 2019 when two-thirds of the waste was sequestered in the buildings? So we have been granted an appeal and for this, our State Lands Commission suit as well, and that's pending. Then there was a formal nuclear regulatory process called a 2.206 that was filed on behalf of our attorneys. It was a part of the legal process that outlined some of these issues with regard to the burial and the canisters and the lack of regulation by the NRC. And then another 2.206 that Charles filed, and I'll let him discuss the details of the flooding and the impact of a potential tsunami.
So to really boil down the federal cases to gravy, Levy, one of them is simply saying the whole plan is predicated on the idea that in 20, 30, or 40 years, the federal government is going to step up to the plate and they're going to have a national nuclear waste repository ready to receive the waste at San Onofre, which is why it's okay to have canisters that are only guaranteed to last for 25 years. So
even there, the math doesn't work out. because if it's 30 to 45 years, however long that is, that's not the same as 20.
Yeah. Now, supposedly they have a design life of 60 years and a service life of 100 years, and they use a lot of very slippery language to describe these canisters. But the reality is the manufacturer only has faith in them for 10 to 25 years. So that's an important part of the case, is that there's nowhere to put this off-site, and all the plans are predicated on moving them off-site. And we're very concerned that they've got a temporary solution for a permanent beachfront nuclear waste site. The second Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals suit is also based on a lot of very technical issues, but basically on the premise that this is a very, very bad idea, and that the NRC violated its own rules when it allowed Southern California Edison to build a nuclear waste dump 108 feet from the beach. The second issue is that we have a couple of lawsuits in state court right now, and those are on different issues that involve around whether or not this should have been approved. And then our following issue is an issue with a process with the NRC where we can complain about improper activity by a licensee. That would be Southern California Edison, the company that owns the nuclear waste dump at San Onofre, about their designs and their activities, called a 2.206 petition to revoke. So we filed a couple of petitions to revoke the permits. And the most recent one is the one that I'm most excited about, because it deals with flooding and what happens if this nuclear waste dump, which is located in a tsunami inundation zone, becomes flooded and inundated with water. And there's some interesting ideas and theories about what will happen when that thing gets covered up with salt water.
Now, Edison did do a study. They did an analysis of the flood vulnerability for the nuclear waste at San Onofre, but they're not revealing what the results of that study was. What's the significance of them saying, well, we've got information, but there, Missy, don't worry your pretty little head about it?
That's what's so hilarious about it. The whole thing, I mean, it's tragic, really. It's all top secret. They're saying, well, if we expose what our protection measures are, it would be a proprietary and it's patented information and we can't divulge this. But what's so bizarre is that this secret patented information only takes up one page in this 450-page final safety analysis report. So they've only censored or redacted about a page and a half of material. Well, that's not, a page and a half isn't a plan for dealing with a massive facility the size of several football fields getting flooded with salt water.
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission claiming, or under the auspices, that this information is proprietary for the Holtec, the manufacturer of the cans. And one, it does bode the question, shall we say, that isn't the NRC putting the public's safety and the public's right to know about what the plan is if we have a worst case scenario above the issue of proprietary information? And as Charles indicated, it's, you know, thinly veiled at that.
Yeah, so they've subordinated the public's right to know to the monetary needs of a corporation. And what we're concerned is they're using their so-called right to intellectual property to cover up a horrifically bad design. Because when we look at this, you say, what happens if one of these silos that's got a sizzling hot canister of nuclear waste? Because this stuff is hot. It's, you know, the exterior temperature of some of these spent fuel assemblies can reach 1,000 degrees easily. I think the exterior of the canisters is several hundred degrees at the bottom, and at the top it can be as high as 750 degrees. So when water gets in contact with it, it'll either boil or turn to steam. So once this thing they call an ISFSI, an independent spent fuel storage installation, is flooded, these silos that the cans are in fill up with water. And what Southern California Edison says is, well, the water will boil away gently like a boiling pot of spaghetti. Well, this was in response to our complaint, which said these things are hot enough so that what'll probably happen is the water will be ejected out as steam, kind of like Old Faithful. And that's when they stepped in and said, okay, here's the data. It's not going to shoot out as steam. It's just going to boil gently like spaghetti. But then they didn't answer the question of what about debris? Because when a tsunami rushes in, it isn't sparkling, clear swimming pool water. It's mud and debris and dead fish and rocks and all this other stuff. So what happens if these silos get filled with basically crud, mud? And they haven't really analyzed that. The NRC hasn't analyzed that. Particularly, what happens when all the water inside one of these silos evaporates and leaves salt behind? And our engineer has looked at this and said, you know, there's going to be at least 100 pounds of salt, maybe several hundred pounds of a thick salt slurry at the bottom of these canisters. And if this happens, this passive air cooling system that they've designed that allows cold air to flow around the canister and then be ejected naturally out as hot air isn't going to work, which means the canisters could overheat, which is a real problem. Now, Edison has said, that's not a problem. Okay, so it's deadly radioactive waste. Not a problem. We'll just pump the water out of the flooded silo. No big deal. Well, the problem is there's 73 of these silos. Pumping 73 silos out could take weeks and weeks. And the NRC's only analysis of a flood event goes up to 32 hours. And they don't have anything beyond that event horizon.
That is so stunningly short-sighted and so dangerous. I mean, even to a layperson's understanding of this situation, it sounds like they are setting us up for, if not potential disaster, inevitable disaster with the highly radioactive material. And I believe that the equivalency for each of those canisters is a Chernobyl's worth of radiation.
Yes, yes. As you know, San Onofre Safety has analyzed this, and they say that the cesium-137 alone, in one canister, there's more than what was released at Chernobyl during the entire Chernobyl event.
They don't have a plan for how they're going to do that. That's the other part of what we're talking about. And they say they're going to, you know, siphon off this water or debris, but how are they going to do that? Who are the people? Are those resources that are required to do that already bought, already on site? Nobody is outlining, if that doesn't work, what's your plan B? Because, I don't want to forget, again, everything we're talking about today is in the middle of millions of people.
In all of this, what is the California Coastal Commission's purported responsibility, and how well, in your estimation, are they carrying them out in relation to San Onofre?
The Coastal Commission has an interesting non-regulatory involvement in that they're forbidden by federal law from regulating radiation. So they do have some kind of influence over the site, over how the land is used and how it's permitted. So they can exercise a little bit of control, and they've done that to some extent. One of the things they've done is impose special conditions on Southern California Edison. And here's the bombshell that occurred in the Coastal Commission meeting, and that is that this nuclear waste dump, which they have an Orwellian term for it, it's an independent spent fuel storage installation, or ISFSI, which is almost impossible to pronounce, an ISFSI. But this nuclear waste dump is going to be there basically until it's flooded by sea level rise. It's only a few feet above the water table, or they move it. And one of the things that Southern California Edison has never talked about publicly is the idea of moving this ISFSI before the inevitable sea level rise occurs. However, at the Coastal Commission meeting, there was very openly talking about moving this ISFSI. The meeting was on July 16, and at the very beginning of the meeting, they literally talked about how they were going to potentially remove Once they removed one of the two iconic big domes that looked like breasts at San Onofre, that they'd take this isthmus and move it there. Now, the problem with doing that is this is a multi-billion dollar operation. There's no budget for it. They've already spent the $4 billion or on target for spending it on the current isthmus, the current nuclear waste dump, and now they want to build another one. So we're kind of looking at this and wondering if this is just a construction boondoggle and a make-work project for Southern California Edison, where they're just sharpening their financial knives for another profitable nuclear waste project.
There was another surprise, which actually has only been discovered in the last week, that is tremendously alarming about what is supposed to happen to the waste at San Onofre, or what has not been planned for the waste at San Onofre. And that has to do with the spent fuel pool. Nina, could you talk to that?
Absolutely. I want to frame up this July 16th meeting with the California Coastal Commission that, of course, was held Zoom. It was, by their own definition, a quote-unquote special meeting that was scheduled with only one item on that agenda, and it was to approve Edison's inspection and maintenance plan of this entire site. That was passed back in the October 17th, 2019 meeting under special condition number 19. And special condition number 19 required that Edison form that inspection and maintenance plan and submit it to the California Coastal Commission by a deadline of March the 31st, which they did. Unfortunately, you know, when that language was drafted, the special condition number 19, we were at that meeting as well as, you know, hundreds of people were at that meeting. And special condition number 19 was never on a handout when you walked into that meeting. It was never put up on a PowerPoint, and it was only read one time during that meeting to the commissioners to vote on. And it also then contained an addendum. And that addendum read something like this, that Southern California Edison would get approval of their inspection and maintenance plan in order to remove the spent fuel pools, or July 2020, whichever came first. Well, that language was crafted all the way back in, you know, October 17th, 2019. I mean, it was drafted on the fly. It was drafted the day of the meeting. It was voted on the day of the meeting. And so when they held this July 16th special meeting to approve Edison's inspection and maintenance plan, then that automatically approved special condition number 19 with that addendum, which approved, gave approval, authorization for Edison to remove the spent fuel pools.
In other words, the spent fuel pool, which is the one emergency place available on site. Should anything go wrong with the canister, should anything go wrong with the fuel rods, they should only be able to remove them from there. But the only place, if there is an emergency, to put the spent fuel rods would be in the fuel pool, which now they have permission to do away with.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, just a little bit of background on the spent fuel pool. It's a very deep, I think 65 feet or whatever, very deep, wide pool that cools. You know, it's a safe place for those cans if they have to be repaired for any reason or repackaged for any reason. The only other option to doing that is something called a hot cell, and we don't have one of those. We don't have a hot cell. So this is our only option if something goes sideways. I'd like to remind your listeners at this point that we've had many, many things go sideways since this whole process started. And the process started with things going sideways when Southern California Edison was not forthcoming and claimed that the replacement steam generators were a like-for-like replacement when they knew that they were not. That led to a radiation leak that shut the plant down. And then that led to this radioactive nuclear waste being buried. And the first four cans that were in the ground, they found a deficiency in the shims.
When you say deficiency, does that mean that they were leaking? Was there some other problem with them?
Yeah, let me jump in here, Levy. These fuel assemblies, there's 37 of them inside each of these giant canisters. They're extremely heavy, and they're held in place by an aluminum egg crate assembly. They're extremely hot. They have to be cooled constantly. So at the bottom of this assembly, they decided to put what they call standoff shims in, and they're basically not much different from a 4 or 5 inch bolt that you'd buy at a hardware store, like a 1/4 inch bolt. They drilled a hole in the bottom of the aluminum, which is about 1/2 inch thick, screwed the bolt inside, and when they started putting them inside the containers, they were just breaking off. And I mean, it was really like they hired Bob, the backyard handyman, to go around and design a nuclear waste containment system. And at the last minute, they thought of this improvement that wasn't approved of by the NRC. And what happened was, is when they got these things into the field, these bolts were breaking off and rattling around. And I mean, one thing you do not want with nuclear waste is bolts breaking off in the canisters, rattling around with nuclear waste. It's just, it was amateur hour. It was crazy.
And it shut the burial down for several weeks. That was in March. That was only like 6 weeks into the burial starting. They only had 4 cans in the ground when they opened the 5th can and found these loose bolts that Charles was talking about. But then just following that, we have the near-miss drop. And that shut the burial down for 11 months and revealed all kinds of violations of federal law.
Yeah.
How do they keep moving forward with this, given the ongoing litany from the steam generators to the bolts to it being so close to the ocean and a tsunami earthquake zone, 5/8 of an inch thick? I mean, there are so many things going against this, and yet it seems unstoppable.
Keystone Cop regulators, that's the problem. And then when you look at, let's just touch on the issue of what Nina called a near miss. The NRC has also called it a near hit. This was an instance where we had a 100,000-pound canister of nuclear waste literally resting on a 1/4-inch steel flange, where if that flange had broken or given way, that canister would have dropped 18 feet to the ground. It would have been a huge, potentially industrial disaster, even though they say nothing would have happened.
And I'd like to talk about something other than the technical issues, because getting back to this California Coastal Commission meeting, all 10 of the commissioners voted to approve Edison's inspection and maintenance plan after hours of questions about how flawed it was and how many outstanding issues there still was. Didn't have anything to do. What did they say they did at the end of the meeting? They held their nose and voted to approve anyway. Well, you know, Levy, why would they have to hold their nose if it didn't stink? Okay, and that's the part I want to get into, is that every single agency, whether it be state agency or federal agency, is in lockstep with the utility companies that have an enormous amount of power, an enormous amount of money, an enormous amount of political power. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure this one out. They've kind of been claiming victim of circumstance for many years.
The Coastal Commission as a victim of circumstance, as opposed to the people of Southern California?
Yeah, because as Charles said, they keep saying they don't have jurisdiction over anything radioactive. That's right, they don't. However, the Coastal Commission is the commission that passed the key things that moved this forward. They passed back in October 6th of 2015 the permit for Edison to bury the waste. How could they do that? Because they were the only agency that had the jurisdiction to grant that permit. And I would like to point out to you that not only did they grant that permit in October of 2015, they granted it knowing that Edison had just applied for and received massive emergency planning exemptions from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And then secondly, last year, yeah, they didn't have jurisdiction over radioactivity, but they had the jurisdiction for another key decision, and that key decision was to give Edison the permit to demolish those buildings. And again, Edison could not have done that if the State Lands Commission would have, on behalf of the people of the state of California, said, hey, wait a minute. You know, just so you know how ridiculous this situation was, the environmental impact report with the state lands conducting for San Onofre was in the middle of the public input period when we had the near-miss accident of August the 3rd that the nuclear officer at San Onofre literally lied about. And I use that word lied for a reason. It wasn't just that he didn't tell the truth about what happened and a whistleblower had to step forward. He actually said in that meeting that there was some downtime for maintenance and gave a specific alibi for why they ceased the burial.
So if the whistleblower had not come forward, there's no way we would have known about this.
Exactly. That's right. The only way that we were informed of what really happened is because somebody had the courage of listening to an executive for Edison's standing in front of, you know, hundreds of people at a public meeting and lie. You know, we're very grateful for that courage.
We covered that on Nuclear Hot Seat, including the entire recording of the whistleblower's testimony at that time, and I will link to that for the website on this particular program. Moving forward on this, where do we go now? What's a next step? What can be done to stop this juggernaut that seems to be putting the people and economy and safety of Southern California at risk?
I think more people just have to wake up to the fact that this is not a little local problem. I mean, you got to keep in mind that one of the reasons that these decisions are being made is, you know, there's a lot of money and power behind what it is we're talking about. But that money comes from the ratepayers, you and me. And we're the ones that are at risk if something goes sideways. There are people behind these decisions, and we're actually just asking them to be accountable for making them.
Well, if they're not going to respond to being asked nicely to be accountable, and we know they're certainly not, and there is the need for that legal gun to be leveled at them, what might be the next step, and what might listeners to Nuclear Hot Seat do to assist you in taking it?
I think much of this has to do with awareness and the intensity of awareness. And of course, Libby, you're doing splendid work with Nuclear Hot Seat, and I think that it would be worth reminding your listeners that what you do is funded entirely by the listeners. Also, I think people can go to Public Watchdogs and educate themselves a little bit more about what we're doing.
And I'd also like to point out something from a perspective of people. And that is, if your listeners up in Los Angeles think about this, and I would like them to at least consider what I'm going to visually describe for them. You know, to the north of Los Angeles, one of the most highly populated areas in the entire country, you've got Diablo Canyon. Diablo Canyon is going to be in the same situation as San Onofre because there's no place to put this waste. And then you've got San Onofre to the south with, you know, as Charles described, Keystone Cops and flying by the seat of their pants from one design failure to the next accident with no accountability. The county of Los Angeles is actually bookended by disaster, and we've got 104 of these across the country. But the beast of Los Angeles needs to wake up, because the county of Los Angeles is bookended by two of these. And one thing that needs to be ringing loud and clear at the end of all that we're talking about is that San Onofre is actually something that the entire utility nuclear industry is watching by setting a precedent. Because after all, if they get away doing what we've been describing, which is factual occurrences here, they're going to do it anywhere they want. And so that's what's going to happen at Diablo Canyon. That's what's going to happen in Indian Point in New York. That's what's going to happen in Pilgrim in Boston. That's what's going to happen at Three Mile Island that, you know, is just going through decommissioning of, I think, Unit 2. And, you know, all you got to do is look at our website. You can see a map of the country. San Onofre is setting a precedent. And above and beyond everything else, these nuclear sites are in the middle of millions of people. So I say, Los Angeles, take a look and wake up. Demand accountability and demand better than this.
Given that Public Watchdogs is already involved with 5 different legal cases, do you have your hands so full that you won't be able to take on anything further and will just ride these out and keep pushing them forward? Or is there room for something else, if necessary?
It's been daunting. I mean, it's been a learning experience for us. And anybody that's ever gone through filing suit and going toe-to-toe with these federal agencies that are represented by the Department of Justice and the ping-pong back and forth of legal documents with Edison and their stable of, you know, 150 attorneys or whatever, it's daunting. And so we're not riding anything out. This is a 24/7 responsibility.
Someone asked me what we do if we lose. And I said, we continue to fight. We'll fight them in the alleys. We'll fight them in the streets. We'll fight them in the halls of justice. We'll fight them in the courts. We'll fight them in civil court. We'll fight them in small claims. We'll fight them in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And we'll take it to the Supreme Court if necessary. We will fight and we will continue to fight.
These corporations and the agencies that we're paying to look out for us and trusting that they will do that are smoothing the semantics and sacrificing public safety. This isn't just thinking about us. This is thinking about many generations. Our grandchildren and all those that we hold dear are going to inherit this mess.
One thing I've noticed about the people that really support what we're doing is they tend to be older. They're usually of grandparent age or grandparents. And they're worried about their grandchildren, and they're worried about their grandchildren's grandchildren, because this is something that will affect not just future generations, but thousands of future generations. This is long-term stuff. This is a long-term problem, and we're in this fight for the long term. This isn't anything that we're going to be able to fix next week. This is an eternally deadly problem.
Charles Langley, Executive Director, and Nina Babiarz, a board member of Public Watchdogs. The website is Public Watchdogs, plural, publicwatchdogs.org. We will link to their videos on San Onofre on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 478. We would also like to thank the ever-vigilant Donna Gilmore of SanOnofreSafety.org for her behind-the-scenes input to this interview. And also on the website, we're going to link to Nuclear Hot Seat number 373. That's the one that contains the full testimony of the whistleblower at San Onofre. That's also the episode with my favorite title ever. Terrorist Group Plants Dirty Bombs on SoCal Beach. Oh, wait! That's Edison and Holtec at San Onofre.
Activists, shout out.
First, from Dr. Gordon Edwards from the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, a note on the passing of Grand Chief Joe Norton of the Kahnawake Council of the Mohawk Nation on Friday, August 15. As Dr. Edwards wrote, it was he, Grand Chief Joe Norton, who smoked the pipe with then-Grand Chief Matabi and others who ceremonially celebrated and solemnified the alliance between the Iroquois Caucus and the Anishinaabek Nation on radioactive waste, and later formulated the Joint Declaration on Radioactive Waste and helped lead the mission to the United Nations in New York City. In April of 2018, he spoke at the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues at United Nations headquarters in New York City, and his talk was entitled Radioactive Waste and Canada's First Nations. We here at Nuclear Hot Seat join with Dr. Edwards in mourning the loss of this great leader. And we're going to link to a really good article out of Germany, Der Spiegel, It's entitled, Is Nuclear Power the Solution to Climate Change? And features a debate between Paul Dorfman and Stefan Quist. It is an intelligent article and allows us to go in depth on both perspectives. Always good to know what the other side is thinking so we can be ready to counter it. Again, that link will be up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 478. Here's today's final thought, and it comes in the wake of our 75th anniversary commemorations of the U.S. dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan. It comes from Albert Einstein, who started the chain reaction of events that led us to this current nuclear state of affairs. He later expressed regret for his role in promoting the building of the atomic bomb and said, I know not what weapons World War III will be fought with, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. To which we can only add, if there are any of us still alive, and if we are still fighting. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, August 18, 2020. Material for this week's show has been researched and compiled from nuclear-news.net, deunrenard.wordpress.com, Beyond Nuclear International, the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, ICANN, otherwise known as ICANN, chicagobusiness.com, StarTribune.com, SamuelLawrenceFoundation.org, SanOnofreSafety.org, Dr. Gordon Edwards, Spiegel.de, JapanTimes.co.jp, Asahi.com, Gizmodo.com, TheGuardian.com, ICIS.com, and the ever-co-opted Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Thanks to all of you who are listening, and truly, we are in both hemispheres, north and south of the equator, in more than 123 countries. So all of you, if you haven't already done so, go to our Nuclear Hot Seat Facebook page, like it, share it, respond to a post. This is the way we get it out, grassroots posting on social media. And if you want to make certain that you never again miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat, go to our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, and scroll down to the yellow opt-in box. Put in your first name, put in an email address. We will send you one email a week with the show and a little bit of material about what's in the show so that you get it as soon as it posts. Now, you are my eyes and ears on the ground, all of you who are listening to this. So if you know of a story, if there's something you think should be covered but hasn't been covered by the show, you got a hot tip, a lead of somebody to interview, please let me know. Send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. This is where I get a lot of the interesting stories and leads, and I'm always interested in hearing from you. And if you've got any attagirls to share, I always appreciate those too. They help me keep going. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2020, Libby Halevy and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevy of Hartestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that the last thing anyone who opposes nuclear wants to be able to say is, I told you so. Let's hope we never have to go there. And there you have it. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. So don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.